Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg, joined, as always, in Zoom conference by the Athletics Mets beat writer Tim Britton. And Tim, step away from that hot stove, because it is sizzling.
Do you use hot stove for July? I thought that was just an off-season thing.
Oh, yeah. It's all the hot stove. Yeah, you're right. I'm off my game. You know, I'm off my game. But, I mean, something's sizzling.
Yeah, I mean, we are recording this. It is 7 p.m. Eastern time on Thursday night, so there's 21 hours to go until the trade deadline. Knowing how this works something is going to happen between now and then that will make everything we say not just irrelevant, but seem like especially off target or stupid.
Yeah, this is a... It is a really dicey time to be recording a podcast, but we owe this service to our listeners, of course, and so we will power forward bravely, in spite of the fact that it seems like, you know, we're already at this phase where, as Mets fans may remember from the Carlos Gomez non-trade and Wilmer Flores weeping on the field in one of the great human moments in baseball history in my mind. Sometimes these things seem like they're done and they're not done as we record on Thursday night before the deadline. It seems like the Yankees have already announced acquiring Joey Gallo. It sounds like they've also acquired Anthony Rizzo. Max Scherzer was reportedly dealt to the Padres, and now it sounds like that is dialed back a little bit and that deal's not quite done. It does sound like Scherzer is not going to be a fit for the Mets, both because those three NL West clubs in contention are all seemingly vying for starting pitching, and because it sounds like neither the Nationals nor Scherzer is eager to put him on a division rival in New York.
Yeah, I mean, as we talked about earlier in the week, the scenario in which Max Scherzer would have come to the Mets was very unlikely then, and it basically involved the Nats being totally cool with trading him within the division, which Mike Rizzo's history as an executive suggested he would not be, and that Scherzer himself really would have wanted to go to the Mets, which I don't, you know, there wasn't like hard evidence against that at that point, but there also wasn't evidence in favor of that, and neither of those things the Mets needed to happen before even talking about a trade acquisition cost happened. And so I think that was one of the, you know, that podcast was irrelevant by like Tuesday afternoon or whatever it was, whenever we learned that yeah, Max Scherzer doesn't really want to come to the Mets. The Nationals don't really
want
to.
Hey, he doesn't want New York. He doesn't want New York. Good riddance.
If he can't make it here, he can't make it anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, who can blame someone for exercising their 10-5 rights that they've earned and wanting to put himself in what seems like it's shaping up to be a phenomenal pennant race on the West Coast, but it leaves the Mets in a spot where we are wondering who the big target is for them. They have been linked to, in uncertain terms, to Jose Berrios, a guy we talked about earlier in this season. It sounds like the cost for Berrios will be prohibitively high for the Mets, especially since, again, whichever team lands Max Scherzer is leaving two teams that in the division that wanted Max Scherzer. And to me, it's a very strange time to be looking at prospects lists. And I would say that probably, you know, this year more than ever before, you have to take all of the prospect lists and consider the evaluation of prospects as we know it with several grains of salt, because they didn't play last year. And so teams, I would guess that teams' evaluations of prospects probably vary more from the consensus national evaluations more now than they ever did in recent memory. But it does seem like the Giants and the Padres and the Dodgers just have more minor league depth to deal from than the Mets do, and probably a little more urgency to add a starting pitcher like Berrios.
Yeah, I mean, I think we saw this with like the Yankees trade for Joey Gallo in terms of prospect evaluations. You know, the preseason evaluation was that none of those guys were like top 10 organizational prospects for the Yankees. But, you know, the prospect evaluator said a lot had changed during the course of the first 3 months of the minor league season and even spring training and all that. And you see that with the Mets. Like Tyler McGill is someone who I think coming into the season would have been like, you know, 18th to 20th on the Mets prospect list. and certainly has performed much better than that. And I think a lot of people within the Mets organization were confident in him, you know, off of his instructional league performance last year, off of what he did in minor league spring training and a little bit at the end of major league camp, and certainly what he had done in AA to start the year, that was a guy who was a lot better than what the preseason prospect evaluation off of really the 2019 season would have pegged him at. So I think it's a little hasty to judge trades based off of how prospects were ranked back in February off of no season last year. With the Mets pitch, you know, with the NL West, you've got the Dodgers have had a very deep farm system for a very long time. The Giants have rebuilt it over the last couple of years under Farhan Zaidi, who was in LA for a while. And the Padres have obviously built that farm system significantly in the last few years and unloaded a lot now in the last, you know, 12 months for pitching. It could be like they trade for Mike Clevinger, Yu Darvish, Blake Snell, Joe Musgrove, and Max Scherzer all within a 12-month span. That would be rather impressive, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Mets, we know they have a top-heavy farm system that their top 6 to 8 guys they really like, and you can stand them up with a lot of other organizations, but they don't have the depth beyond that. And because they don't have the depth beyond that, you feel less comfortable trading any of those top 6 or 8. You know, this is, you know, if they still had Anthony Kay and Simeon Woods Richardson from the Stroman trade, if they still had Josh Wolf and Isaiah Green from the Lindor trade, if they still had, you know, we can go back to Jared Kelenic and Justin Dunn in the Seattle trade, like those, you know, they've made good use of those guys, good in quotes, depending on how you feel about the Cano trade in particular, in the past, and now they don't have them there to make the deals right now right. that they might want to. If you look at, I mean, we can go kind of through some of the rumored guys that they're looking at, like Berríos. You know, I just heard a couple weeks ago, basically, that, you know, the Twins were not asking for what the Blue Jays wanted for Stroman a couple years back. That was Kay and Woods Richardson. Kay was like a fringe top 100 prospect who was near major league ready. And Woods Richardson was a guy who, they, you know, I think a lot of people thought would eventually be a top 100 prospect as he got closer to the major leagues. Minnesota was asking for basically two of the Mets' top that top group, that top 6 or 8 prospects, two of those guys, plus someone that was under team control on the major league roster. So you can imagine something like a David Peterson plus Ronnie Mauricio plus JT Ginn kind of thing. And the Mets thought that was a lot, mm-hmm. And they didn't want to do that then. I've heard that the price is essentially the same now with 21 hours to go. And you would imagine, especially if Scherzer ends up in the National League West, that one of the other teams there might be more willing to meet that price than the Mets. And so I don't think Berríos is coming to New York. I think the Mets are probably looking more at the rental market for starting pitchers, in part because they've gotten good news of late as well, that Carlos Carrasco is coming back on Friday to make his season debut, that, you know, Jacob deGrom is throwing again, at least. He threw a bullpen session on Thursday, and they expect him back really within the next, I would say, 2 to 3 weeks. And then, you know, they added Rich Hill already, so they know who their next 5 starters are going to be, which is something they haven't been able to do in 6 weeks. And if they get DeGrom back, that gives them 6 healthy starters. They still want to add a starter, but it's probably not a number 2 starter as so much as it is like a 4 or 5 who, you know, again, if you need him to start a playoff game, you want someone capable of starting a playoff game for you, but not someone that is guaranteed to start a playoff game for you. At this point,
is it weird that I feel ambivalent about this trade deadline? Like I want the Mets to want to win, and I recognize that they have a path to a pretty clear path to the NL East pennant, despite not burying the Braves as we hoped they would this week. But especially if the Padres wind up with Scherzer, or any of the NL West teams does, and another one gets Berríos. It feels like, it just feels like it's such a tough year to go all in on, because they have just been so weirdly underperforming in so many different ways, and because they have had so much of this, like the outside of Stroman, you know, the either injuries or ineffectiveness up and down the rotation. So I don't know. In so many instances, I feel like prospects and the way fans especially just value their own team's prospects is wildly overblown. Like, I just think people think they're everybody that they hear is going to be good is going to wind up good, and it almost never happens. But I don't know. It feels like if you can get a guy like Berríos and he's coming back for next year, that's one thing. But if it's a rental player, like you're going out to trade for Kyle Gibson or whoever it is, it doesn't excite me that much.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, it's extremely weird that you're ambivalent about the trade deadline. Everyone has strong opinions about every aspect of the trade deadline and every potential move of the trade deadline, including non-moves as well. You have to know if you are strongly for or against John Gray, and you've got to know right now. And it's going to color how you feel about him and the entire team for the next 2 months.
Big ghost guy? John, do you know John Gray is a big ghost guy? He's into ghosts?
I think I did read that earlier. And Nick Groke, our Rockies writer, wrote a very good profile of John Gray earlier this season that I enjoyed reading. It had a great first line that I don't remember off the top of my head, but it's worth reading. Just Google Nick Groke, John Gray. There you go.
So for my instant reaction is I'm for it. Bring on the ghost guy. I love a weirdo.
And I think, you know, yeah, the three best teams in the National League, like the Mets are not one of the three best teams in the National League. I think, you know, they're pretty clearly the fifth best team in the National League right now.
And just barely holding off the Reds, you know?
Right. But I think you'd also say in 2015, they were pretty clearly the fifth best team in the National League, and the playoff format favors them this year the same way it did in 2015, where if you've got the three best teams, the teams you're most scared of in the playoffs, all in the same division, you've only got to beat one, and there's a chance that you get home field advantage against that team, despite having a worse record. You can imagine, you know, if the playoffs started tomorrow, the Mets would play the Brewers in the first round, who the Brewers are better than the Mets this season so far, but not necessarily the team that scares you as much as the teams out west. And then the Dodgers and Padres would be playing a wild card game. The winner would play the Giants. And let's say the Mets played the Dodgers or Padres in the NLCS. If they got past the Brewers, they'd have home field for that series. So it's a strange quirk in the way it's lined up that really worked out to their advantage in 15, where they were the fifth best team in the league. They beat the fourth best in the NLDS, and they had home field over the third best in the NLCS to get to the World Series. They didn't have to beat the best team in the NL that year, St. Louis. They didn't have to beat the second best and arguably the hottest going into the playoffs in Pittsburgh. And they could follow that same course this year. And I think they think that their ceiling as a team, if, and there's a lot of ifs here, if DeGrom is healthy and able to go deep into games and able to pitch every fifth day, if you've got Carrasco or Syndergaard back as kind of their usual self by the postseason, and if this offense looks like it did for 15 minutes earlier this month and less like it did the rest of the season and this past week, then you think this is a team that can do damage and that, you know, acquiring a pitcher right now who can get you there, who can make sure you don't fall apart in August and September and lose a very winnable division, is worth some minor prospect cost. I do understand the idea of, like, you shouldn't be trading Francisco Alvarez for 8 starts of Max Scherzer or something like that.
It's an interesting point about the offense, like the ceiling, because, you know, coming into the season, everyone expected this offense to be not just like good, but I thought really good. And they have instead been really bad, one of the worst offenses in the National League. And so I can still buy the concept that you're like, okay, well, like, just look at these players. They're better than this. And eventually, we know how baseball works. Eventually, the good baseball players come around. And so, you know, what if that happens in September and October and you still have the good pitching? Like, I can see the case. It just feels like there's so much uncertainty. Really, so much of it just is wrapped up in DeGrom's status, because the team looks one way going into the postseason with DeGrom, and it looks a whole different way going into the postseason without DeGrom, obviously, and which would be true for any team. But they're the one that has that guy, and he's the one who has been banged up a little bit. So I don't know. I'm not sure. I guess I would have to fall back on my depends on the deal stance on just about every potential move here. But if the pitching market, and because all year we've been talking about how, okay, they need one more starting pitcher, like that should be their deadline priority. If it seems like there's not a huge upgrade out there for them. If there's not going to be someone who's like appreciably better than Rich Hill or a Carlos Carrasco piggyback situation, do they turn to Chris Bryant or Javi Baez or Trevor Story?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can look in that direction as, you know, you might be able to get the most value out of this specific trade market by getting someone lesser on the pitching side and going a little bit more all in on the position player side. We've seen some big prices for rental position players, the Starling Marte trade, you know, Jesus Luzardo going back the other way from Oakland is
that was a weird one. You know, I thought that was go on.
You're not the only one who thought that. I've right. talked to people in front offices who thought that was a weird one. And it, you know, it's in part like
Oakland. Yeah, such a big prospect, and for Oakland to be the team giving him up, it's an odd deal.
Yeah, you know, Oakland maybe because of their stadium situation puts a little bit more into this current season, and maybe is a little bit more down on Luzardo than other teams. And then you know the Yankees and the proposed price that we're seeing at this hour for Anthony Rizzo. That is a fairly large prospect package to give back, but they're also getting the Cubs to pay the entirety of Rizzo's contract to stay under the luxury tax, which if the Mets were doing, you'd hear a lot from the fan base. And I think it's very strange to see the Yankees taking that course at this moment, like the same course the A's took with Marte. But other than that, you know, the price, the cost, the acquisition cost for rental position players is lower than it is for pitchers. Everyone wants a pitcher, you know, position players don't fit quite as many teams. Some of the guys the Mets are interested in fit a number of teams because they're positionally diverse, like Chris Bryant. But it does seem like, you know, with Story, for instance, there just isn't the market for him that you might have expected going into the season and going into the deadline, that there's just not that many teams that really could use a shortstop. And I don't know that everyone sold on him just seamlessly transitioning to second base or third base if needed the rest of the season. Maybe it is a little bit easier to get him than it would be otherwise for the Mets. I think that the issue with both Story and with Gray is that the Rockies are kind of a mess. The front office, you know, they Jeff Bright is their GM, resigned a couple months ago. They've had some assistants leave. The guy who ran their draft is now the GM, and Bill Schmidt. And, you know, I heard a few weeks back that they weren't talking to anyone before the All-Star game. And that they, you know, Nick Groke, again, our excellent Rockies reporter, this is really a Nick Groke podcast, is that reported that, you know, teams didn't really know who to call with the Rockies. And I'd heard, you know, as of this afternoon, that the Mets hadn't really gained any traction with them to this point. And it kind of reminds me of like where the Mets were in 2018 after Sandy Alderson had stepped down for taking his leave of absence. And you had, you know, John Rico and J.P. Ricciardi and Omar Minaya running things. They kind of all delegated their own little things, and they ended up not really doing anything at the trade deadline because it was really hard for them to run an operation that way. And I think that could be a reason, you know, Colorado has said that they don't need to trade Story. They could offer him the qualifying offer and get something back. You could apply the same logic to Gray. You could say, we don't need to trade him. We could do the same with the qualifying offer there. That's an iffier proposition. But, you know, I think if another team had those two players, you'd be really confident they'd be traded. But because of the turmoil in the Colorado front office, I don't know that there's anyone in baseball who they'd roll their eyes at the idea of those guys still being Rockies at 5 o'clock tomorrow. But it wouldn't surprise anyone, really.
So, I mean, what about Baez? Because to me, that's the guy. And you know, obviously, Bryant is a superstar, and there's a lot of ways in which he fits the Mets. But Baez, for his elite defensive ability, right? He can replace Lindor defensively until Lindor returns, and then be an elite defender either at third or at second. Certainly not a guy who gets on base a ton. A free swinger, we know, a guy who strikes out a lot, but an aggressive hitter, and a guy who's still got enough power and brings enough to a table to be a really valuable player. Like, does that look like a fit to you?
I think if the Cubs are trading Rizzo, I would actually, I don't know how to look at that as a reflection of how they feel about Baez. I think everyone thought going into the trade deadline that certainly Bryant was going to be traded, and then maybe Rizzo or Baez. Rizzo and Baez were the two guys you thought the Cubs might hold on to and then sign in the offseason. Maybe they're willing to trade both of them and then try to re-sign them again in the winter. If they really want to.
I mean, at this point, I feel like the jig is up on that. That's always been a talking point. Like, oh, if they want to re-sign him, they can't trade him. It feels like everyone knows now you can trade a guy and then re-sign him. The Aroldis Chapman thing, right? Like, and I think if you were, especially like a player like Javi Baez, it's a smart, savvy dude. Like, if he was really invested in being on the Cubs long term, he should want the Cubs to trade him now.
Yeah, I do think there is the counter argument, like John Lester with the Red Sox, when they traded him in 2014 to Oakland. He had been with the Red Sox his whole career and said that offseason that like pitching for another team was not as different as he thought it was going to be. Huh. And so it opened him up. He didn't feel as scared of signing with someone else besides Boston. And, you know, the Cubs did offer him more money than the Red Sox did, which also helped that winter. And I think if you're the Cubs and if they're invested in re-signing Baez, I don't know that the Mets, the team that he just said on a podcast that he would like to play for because he likes Francisco Lindor so much, is the team you want to trade him to. Because that's probably makes him think that, you know, the Mets are a team that can certainly has the financial capability of signing Baez this winter. And, you know, if he really enjoys playing next to Lindor, maybe he takes less money to do so. So I don't know how to read that from their perspective. I don't know enough about how Chicago feels about those guys. From the Mets side of things, you know, Baez is a guy who is going to really frustrate a lot of the fan base, from what I know, because of the way he is as an offensive player.
Oh, he will, you know, frustrate, but at times, I mean, so many times, thrill. Like, he is a special type of player.
He's different from anyone else in the sport, I think. You know, you look at his stat line today, it's 130 strikeouts and 15 walks. So it's a different kind of bat. And I think there is, like, that he is still valuable. This is a guy who was the second in the MVP a couple of years back, and just brings a different style of offensive capabilities to the table, and certainly so much defensively to the table, especially if you're combining him with Lindor up the middle. It would be a weird move to me if you said offense is our issue, let's get Javi Baez, because I think the guy he displaces in your lineup, whether that's, you know, it'd probably be J.D. Davis, is a guy who is a better all-around offensive player, probably, and has been this year for sure.
But not a better all-around player.
So I think Baez could fit. I think, you know, if you're ranking those three big position players, I'd still probably go Bryant, Story, Baez in that order. But, you know, it comes down to the price on them. I would imagine the price for Bryant is higher than the price for Story is higher than the price for Baez. And, you know, I think the Mets, because they have different directions they can go in, are going to try to find where they can get the most value.
Baez would be, by the way, the Mets position player leader in wins above replacement this year, despite the fact that he has a 289 on base percentage at entering play on Thursday. It's not been a especially good offensive year for him. He just adds so much value in so many different ways. Most famously with his, or I don't know if it's most famously, but very notably with his like tagging and just his instincts defensively. I'm sure you saw the play. We might have even spoken about the play earlier this year where he ran backwards, back toward home, and got himself in a rundown between first and which is like a Jedi mind trick on top of everything else. I'm pulling for, that's the guy I want, and I don't think it's gonna happen, but man, I think that would be fun if Lindor got going and we're back and Baez was there and it's got this 2016 World Series feel all over again. I don't believe in this stuff, but I feel like the irrational Met fan center of me just says like, that's a guy who is electric and who is like, if you need that catalyst to finally get this offense going, I feel like maybe it's Javi Baez. Like maybe it's just like that. There's now this like extremely exciting player. Not that watching Pete Alonso hit 454-foot home runs isn't exciting. Not that watching Lindor play isn't exciting. They have a lot of exciting players, but Baez is he's like a spark plug to me. I feel really good about that one.
Yeah, I mean, he's a very entertaining player to watch. Everyone likes watching Javi Baez. I do love the way he tags guys out. He's great at that. Lindor's also very good at that.
He came up to the major leagues with the Major League Baseball logo already tattooed on the back of his neck. Right? Like, that's cool.
So he was ready for it. He was, I think I had him on my fantasy team in like 2012, years before he came up, because I was ready for that. Ready for his offensive performance at a premier defensive position that took a little while to materialize, and you know, look, he may never be as good as he was in 2018 when he was the MVP runner up, but still brings value offensively in addition to what he has with the glove.
All right, we got some questions. We solicited questions right before the show, and so not surprisingly, they're all about many of them about the trade deadline. One person wants to know if it's okay to use Narco to wake up his toddlers. Obviously it is. Let's go with this. Just as a good wrap up, would Chris Bryant be that big of an upgrade from JD Davis? This is from Tom Shortell, T Shortell on Twitter. He says, would Chris Bryant be that big of an upgrade from Davis? Better defensively and offers more versatility, sure, but Davis probably has the better bat at this point. Your thoughts?
So usually we field questions from people from your past. Tom Shortell was my grade school teammate on the baseball team at St. Leo's
in
New Jersey. So it's good that we finally get one from one of my buddies. You know, with Bryant, like we were talking about Baez versus Davis, better all around player.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because of his ability, and like, he plays third base better than Davis does.
Way better.
He also plays right field and left field and first base better than Davis does. And I think it's interesting to think about if you bring in Bryant and, you know, you retain JD Davis is not part of the trade, that, you know, you can play both of them at times. You can have Bryant, you know, maybe against a good left-hander, given the way Michael Conforto has struggled against good left-handers this year. You could have Chris Bryant start in right field, and you know, your lineup against lefties, the Mets, maybe 11-20 against left-handed starters, because they beat Fried last night, but lost to Drew Smyly today. It's not a very good record against left-handed starters, even though their OPS against lefties is better than their OPS against righties, which is strange. But Conforto in particular has struggled against them. And so having Bryant and Davis in the lineup against a lefty could be helpful. You know, you look at their offensive numbers over the last three-ish years, and on like a per at-bat level, Davis has been better. His weighted runs created plus is 133. Bryant's is 127. It's not a huge difference, and Bryant has had 400 more plate appearances.
Staying
healthy.
Well, also, don't you think that because Davis is used like against every lefty and he sits against some righties, like Bryant as an everyday guy is not getting exactly the same quality of matchups as Davis is.
That's true too, is he doesn't have the platoon advantage quite as regularly as Davis has. So I think if you're asking who's going to be a better offensive player these next 2 months, I would probably still pick Bryant over Davis. I think it's closer than you generally think. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you're talking about the size of the upgrade, you have to take into account the defensive side of things, the versatility side of things, but also, you know, you weigh that against what is the upgrade in your starting rotation. If you've got one prospect you can move and you can get Chris Bryant with that guy, or you can get a starting pitcher with that guy, you know, is Bryant over Davis a bigger upgrade than, you know, insert your starting pitcher over Rich Hill or over you know, Tylor Megill over the final 2 months, or Taijuan Walker in a playoff series, that kind of decision. When you've got the Mets don't need to do anything. They can probably win their division with the team they have because the division's not very good. But there's a lot of areas they can get better in, and it's interesting to see how they prioritize those.
And we will find out soon enough, because the trade deadline is bearing down upon us. We will be back next week to discuss whatever the Mets did or didn't do, and how they've played since doing it, or how they will play after doing it. Tim, as always, great talking to you, and best of luck covering the trade deadline.
I'm excited for us to re-record this in 20 minutes after they've made a big move.
It's until then.
Adios.
Peace.